are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, July 12th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. On a Michael Thursday, pinch hitting for the four-day work week man himself on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Megan Day. She's a journalist and writer for The Jacobin. We're talking about how capitalism is ruining science, why keeping market, why creeping marketization has created perverse incentives for researchers, threatening the wholesale corruption of science itself. Donald Trump, the blimp has arrived in the UK. Protests will greet him, and nonsense will continue to pour out of his mouth. He's now winning a NATO. Winning a NATO. The Judge Kavanaugh nomination marches forward. The war to destroy the last vestiges, women's rights, the next attacks on labor, reproductive justice, everything else. The Supreme Court versus democracy as Democrats start to rally a bit more effectively than they did out of the gate. And there is a new piece of legislation by the same man who now represents Congress but used to be a prosecutor who let off Eric Garner's killer that would criminalize Antifa. It's part of a wave of legislation that started at a state level designed by Republican legislatures to crush down and block public expressions of protests.
Solidarity Antifa?
Solidarity Antifa. In Montgomery County, the Democratic Party has elected a DSA-backed Democratic socialist who's talking about rent control and workers' rights, and now a mediocre third-way corporate Democrat has dropped out of the party and is running as an independent, potentially creating a spoiler effect because need to be pro-business. We need pro-business.
He's not even a Democrat.
In this case, he actually is literally the Democrat. But yes, belying that whole nonsense argument. And Brazil's Workers' Party has called out the lawfare coup, which has imprisoned President Lula da Silva after a weekend mess, which saw him ordered to be released from prison, but in fact remaining there. All that and more on today's Majority Report. I want to get to this story briefly before we get to this sound. And this is a really actually important point of intervention. There's a debate that people can have about Antifa, its tactics, its ideology, and so on and so forth. It's an area that I am more sympathetic and supportive of Antifa than many, but I understand the validity of some of the critiques, and I don't think it's conceptually and intellectually above reproach. That said, Richard Spencer clip was one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life, and more importantly, as soon as legislation like this happens, all the other nonsense goes out the window. This is actually an analog to why someone like me is like, all right, whatever, but now it's time to vote for Hillary in November. Because when greater threats appear, it doesn't mean that the debates and arguments go out the window, but it does mean in terms of primary focus of action and resources, the immediate threat needs to be addressed. And the immediate threat right now is a piece of legislation that Dan Donovan is proposing in the House of Representatives. He's a Republican who represents Staten Island, and I'm going to touch on, or actually already teased it in the intro. He was previously a prosecutor who chose to not bring murder charges, or at the very least manslaughter charges, against the cop who choked out Eric Garner on the street. That was, of course, the man who was selling loose cigarettes, who got put in a chokehold while police stood on and watched. Bystanders asked him to stop as he was clearly murdering and killing the guy. And Eric Garner obviously was losing his life as the chokehold by the officer continued. This is the same guy that chose to not prosecute that crime. And he has now proposed a piece of legislation which quote unquote, this is from The Independent, imposes penalties on anyone who, quote, injures, oppresses, threatens, or intimidates, unquote, another person while wearing a mask or a disguise. Now, let's break this down. From a legal perspective, if you injure somebody else, if you oppress somebody else, I don't know what the hell that means. But let's start before we get to the nonsense. Injure somebody else is assault or battery of some sort. That's illegal. Okay? So no need for new lawmaking there. And incidentally, if you're concerned about who's actually instigating violence in these conflicts, go look at the fascists, not the people resisting them. The capital murder that has come out of these conflicts so far was the death of Heather Hare by a young pro-Nazi activist aligned with the far right. Oppress, I don't know what that means. Maybe we're in intellectual dark web territory, like my freedom of speech, which means, of course, for these people, don't protest or question anything I say. So don't have a counter protest to my protest because you exercising your free speech would threaten my free speech. And then intimidate or threaten. Now, again, actually intimidate or threaten are both other things that if you actually clearly legally demonstrated that, those are actually things that are already on the books. So putting this disguise moniker is, first of all, people across the board wear disguises. So theoretically, this could be used against right-wing forces. We know it's not going to be. Number two, it's obviously specifically targeted at a group like Antifa that is primarily publicly known for hiding their identities because they don't want to be doxxed by people that support Nazi policies, as an example. And it adds the type of vagueness of this writing, by the way, could literally mean anything. A disguise doesn't literally have to be a mask because you could just be, I don't know, wearing an outfit. Maybe like Matt goes to a protest and wears like a 1980s style Adidas tracksuit.
I'm a furry.
Yeah, maybe he's a furry. It doesn't mean a thing. But we all know how this legislation will be applied. And frankly, as a second order issue more broadly, this is a cooling effect on protests and public demonstrations of any sort, period, which everybody should oppose, frankly. That actually is an important principle that we should fight for.
Yeah.
But, go ahead.
The penalties are absurdly stiff.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to.
Sorry.
People could get up to 15 years in prison, 15 years in prison under this legislation by Donovan. So, and then I just want to quote briefly from a member, Janine Renee, who Cunningham was a member of the New York's Metropolitan Anarchist Coordinating Committee. This bill explicitly targets the tactics used by anti-fascists to protect themselves against the violence and harassment of far-right groups who routinely target them. As a result, it should be considered a tacit support of not only fascism, but also dangerous alt-right groups in this country. She's absolutely right. It's part and parcel of broader efforts that we saw at the state level, including legislation in North Dakota that was aimed at the Dakota Alkaline Pipeline protesters, which essentially said that if you got run over by a car protesting, that was legal, essentially. There's no recourse. There's other pieces of legislation on the state level that essentially target you for engaging in acts of civil disobedience or protests that could in any way affect businesses' profit margins. So in other words, it's like, yes, if you're protesting by, I don't know, say a Starbucks that has thrown out two black people who are waiting for 2 minutes before having a meeting, and then people go back to that branch to protest the racism of Starbucks. Well, I guess theoretically, somebody might say, oh man, it looks like there's a big crowd around the Starbucks. I just needed to dunk in for a minute, grab a coffee. I'll go somewhere else. Under some of the interpretations of state statutes that they've put forward, that could mean that the protesters could be at the very least, civilly liable with exorbitant fines for doing that. And that's why when you look at the type of nonsense and fear-mongering and fascist bleeding that somebody like Mike Huckabee did last week about his stupid daughter and about Democrats not respecting the results of the election. First of all, this is exactly what someone like Erdogan says in Turkey. There is an election day, you vote. When the vote's over, you shut the fuck up, period. The majority wins, that's it. That's it. And that is both profoundly anti-democratic and, in fact, even profoundly anti-liberal, if we're being honest about it. And then that number two, that whining and freaking out by Republicans about these acts of protests are not only their typical cultural agreement. They're going to be packaged with policy to criminalize dissent, which makes the New York Times editorial board, Washington Post, David Axelrod, like, be nice and civil, that much more delusional and disgusting, because this is actually in play. This shit isn't a debate about manners. You can oppose all this stuff if you want, but if you don't understand the primary threat of a legislation like this, or even just the J20 protesters, where finally, a couple of days ago, the last charges were dropped against them, but that's still over a year of time of legal threats, wasted time, having your life be invaded for exercising your constitutional rights. Get in the game or shut up. And here are some people in the game. These are people protesting Mike Pence, one of the most loathsome people in the world, in Kansas City, Missouri, I believe. Is that right? Kansas City, Missouri.
It is great to be back in Kansas City with men and women who elected a Congress and a president.
And another important piece of protesting.
Just comment on that. Every time that this response is prompted, that like somebody does something righteous and the response of the crowd is USA, USA, that there's something very powerfully instructive about that. And
right.
So people should keep doing this sort of shit.
Yeah, we're taking it back. Oh, and in case anyone is still confused as to whether this law specifically targets Antifa, there are specific carve-outs for cops. Because, as everyone knows, the cops are allowed to wear disguises and spy on protesters.
Oh, if anything, this legislation, I'm sure, probably even has specific... there's going to be provisions to allow cops to be even more invasive of groups like that, which they already profoundly are, even pre-9/11. Look at infiltration of the environmental and animal rights movement.
Know about them taking pictures of those sorts of organizers is that's obvious why they want the masks off, and that's obvious why the masks are there in the first place, and the masks should be allowed to fucking stay there.
Precisely. Here's more people, though. I will say this is an example, if we want to quote future in a positive sense, mask off, effective protesting, the turtle, the arch scum of the United States Senate. He had a meal disrupted in Kentucky. Here's Mitch McConnell getting it from some people that care about basic human decency and democracy. They're playing Public Enemy.
It was a DJ, I think, that was meant to work at the... It says on the sound sheet, actually.
Hero.
A bar trivia host recognized him and used his speaker to disrupt McConnell's dinner, playing the song Fight the Power by hip-hop group Public Enemy.
That's beautiful.
That's, hey, you want to have an open air dinner. That's what you're going
to
get.
Yeah. Listen to Fight the Power, asshole. All right. We will be right back with Megan Day on the Majority Report. We're talking about why capitalism is ruining science and logic.
We're the science and logic defenders.
We're the science and logic defenders, guys. Sorry to say. Makes me a little bit sick to say it myself. All right. We'll be right back with Megan Day.
I'm A Rasta no live on no clap talent.
What you mean?
Can we go home?
What you mean?
I said we settle and cease. Welcome on a Rasta man. A Rasta no live on no clap talent.
I am
well. Lord America a capital and the whole of Jamaica a capital and a long time them want trick the Rasta man. Like them no know say that one a real African. You think me no member King Ferdinand and keeping Columbus have a golden plan. Them make a brown turn and end up in Caribbean. One Rasta no side kill enough Indian. And turn paradise in a plantation and bring cross one ship load of African. Now here comes the thief in queen from England. Now she come well and Henry Maga. Century part of a century full of separation. And after 400 years, me send a reparation. I know them want to kill me with the taxation. But I beg you, please take me to the motherland. I beg you, carry me go home. I bring me from the east. Come on,
Chronix, Captured Land. I'm trying to remember to tell people the music. Joining us now is Megan Day. She is a staff writer at the Jacobin magazine. Megan, thanks so much for being here. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. It's great to be talking with you. Was just saying to you in the break, I've always learned a lot speaking with you and reading your writing. You have a new piece out in Jacobin called Capitalism is Ruining Science. And you actually start with an observation that seems like it might come as a shock to the Steve Pinkers of the world, which is that science actually predated markets. Can you explain this basic history to us?
Yeah, it's more that I think that's true. The observation that I make is really that the university existed before capitalism.
Right.
The point being that, you know, the university doesn't necessarily operate by market logics, or at least it hasn't all throughout its history. It's often been devoted to other more noble aspirations than maximizing profit and accumulating wealth, and including those of science, right? Like discovering truths about the world around us that can help us build on our collective body of knowledge and better our world. But, you know, as I point out in the piece, there has been a recent trend in the academy toward market logics, toward the dictates of the capitalist market. And we see increasingly that universities are succumbing to market logic, and that therefore science is as well.
So get into that more specifically. Is this about, you know, is it about winning grants? Is it about publish or perish for individual academics? Is it about the need to generate R&D research that can benefit pharma or weapons manufacturers? Kind of get us through the different facets of how these incentive structures are taking over the scientific enterprise.
Yes, definitely. So that's the main thrust of the piece. So I start out by basically pointing out that Ellen Mikeson's Wood is a theorist of capitalism, and she has what she calls a few dictates of the capitalist market, imperatives of competition, accumulation, profit maximization, and increasing labor productivity. And we see all of those increasing in academic science. So primarily, we see that with publish or perish, which is a common maxim, meaning that you need to increase your volume of publications of scientific papers or else your career is going down the toilet. Another thing, though, is funding or famine. This is like the next level above publish or perish. It's, you need to secure funding for your research or else you're not going to be eligible for yet more funding. So that sends scientists on a sort of mad scramble for funding. And the reasons that these things are happening is that, there's a lot of reasons. One is that obviously just our entire society is becoming more and more subservient to these dictates of the capitalist market. But specifically in universities, there is there's a drying up funding stream from tax money. So like public money is not going to universities the way that it once did due to austerity-minded regimes, administrations. So that means that universities are compelled to play by, you know, not public rules, public sector rules, but private sector rules. That means they have to operate like businesses. And businesses, of course, are all about the bottom line, and the health of the bottom line depends on profit maximization. So that, and it's a science itself, right? Like, right. Profit maximization depends on careful and constant evaluation of inputs and outputs. There's a sort of math and a science to it. But the result is that there's been the introduction of a new regime of quantitative performance metrics in universities. And it governs almost everything that scientific researchers do, and it has observable impacts on their work practices. So like you mentioned, there are a lot of different quantitative performance metrics. One is publication count, like I said, you know, publish or perish. And also citations. Citations are being relied upon in professional evaluations in ways that they never were before. And including combined citation publication counts, so like where you appear, how often you appear in indexes, and so on. And then things like that I don't totally understand because I'm not an academic scientist, but the things with names like journal impact factors, and then you also have total research dollars. So this is where we get into funding or famine. And then we've also got patents, which you mentioned before as well. You know, R&D research. So these quantitative metrics are sort of dominating decision making in everything from, you know, hiring new faculty to promoting professors to tenure to also awards and also to funding.
So let's indulge, and we'll actually, this will kind of fuse well with a question of, because you cite research that's showing, in fact, the raw amount of scientific research and productivity is increasing in correlation with this regime. And there is definitely a, you know, the very standard response that you would get, and certainly from the sort of mainstream purveyors of quote-unquote science, and I am thinking specifically of Steve Pinker, but I think even also the kind of cult and mythology around Elon Musk, would say, well, science is increasing, quote-unquote. We need constant innovation, and, you know, two things. One, you know, boo-hoo professors, you know, do your work like everybody else. That's the one very typical kind of punitive neoliberal logic. And then that number two, even if you, they might even say, okay, even you coffee shop, you know, Jacobin lefties, you don't like Raytheon or Pfizer or whatever, but even you would say that, as an example, the internet was a publicly funded, government-driven project, and that's a big point for our side on the socialist end of the equation. And at the same time, it was very much a military project, and one, you know, that was a byproduct of, you know, research that was centered on the military-industrial complex. So they might say, even if you don't like that the R&D is so much going into the corporate sector, that research will still have a spillover effect, not only in markets and product innovation, but just in general raw science. And now you can obviously tell my editorial a little bit in this, because I've really gotten sick of the discourse that just science is like some type of, ironically, like mystical spiritual thing with like its own innate value, versus like specific things like debunking dogmas, creating medicines, which are very good things. But if you don't politicize the concept, you have just this kind of blind faith in science as a teleology, basically. But that being said, the two responses, I think, would be the more science, the better. Maybe you could respond to the quality of the science that's being produced. And that number two, there will be a spillover effect regardless, because, again, essentially more science, better.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe we could call that approach trickle-down science. And I don't think it's, you know, any more sound than trickle-down economics. I think that you have to make political choices from the outset about where you're going to allocate resources and how, in order to improve public well-being, right? Like pursuing science for the well-being of the public is very different than pursuing science for the well-being of corporations' profits. Right. So to go back to your first thing, though, which is the question of quantity. Yeah. Apparently, scientific output, if you measure it by work citations, has doubled every 9 years since roughly World War II. This is from a paper that I cite extensively in my article. The paper is called academic research in the 21st century, maintaining scientific integrity in a climate of perverse incentives and hyper-competition. So long title, but it's a great paper, and authors are Mark Edwards and Siddhartha Roy. And their observation was that actually quantity does not translate to quality. In fact, on the contrary, if you track the effect of these quantitative performance metrics that I was talking about before on the quality of scientific research, you'll find that it has a detrimental effect. So as a result of, for instance, reward systems that incentivize publication volume, scientific papers have become shorter, they're less comprehensive, and they boast worse methods and increase also in false discovery rates. Another one is, you know, in response to, like, the growing emphasis on work citations and professional evaluations, which I talked about a moment ago, reference lists have become bloated to meet career needs, not to meet, you know, the needs of the work itself. And there's an increasing number of peer reviewers requesting that their own work be cited as a condition of publication. And after I published this article, I actually heard from someone who had just gone through this a few days prior, that she was trying to get her paper published in a peer-reviewed journal, and reviewer number two stepped in and said, I really think that this work needs to build more on my work, right? And so you see the way in which, but the reason that reviewer number two was saying this, obviously, is because reviewer number two is under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure to get more citations in order to improve their own career prospects.
Right.
So you see that this actually erodes the integrity and the quality of the work, because when people are experiencing a sort of like precarity and when they're in competition over scarce resources, their priorities change. They're no longer able to simply focus on the integrity of the work. They have to focus on their own bottom line as the university is focusing on its bottom line. So it becomes everybody race to the bottom. And there's a couple of more ways in which this happens. One is that, you know, there's a system right now increasingly where you reward increased grant funding with more professional opportunities for increased grant funding. So, like, the more money you get, the more money you're likely to get. It shows the money is sort of like an award. It shows that you are worth putting money into. And that's the way in which a lot of academic scientists are actually funding their careers. This is because, obviously, we're seeing funding streams dry up from the public sector. Due to austerity and due to privatization. You could call this a form of privatization. But what it results in is scientists spending an outsized amount of their time writing grant proposals, which is not the amount of time. I mean, you should be spending that time thinking about complex, deep questions and, you know, looking for complicated truths. And you also see scientists overselling the positive results of their research to catch the attention of funders, because funders don't want to fund things where, you know, the hypothesis was proven untrue, or where, you know, essentially no information was found, which is good information. When no new information was found using the scientific method, that's actually technically good information in science, but it's not good information in the world of grants. They want to see results that they can package and they can put on their website and they can sell, right?
Yep.
So you see, you actually do see scientists overselling, like I said, the positive results of their research, which actually compromises the integrity of the entire scientific endeavor, I think. And then the final one is that, as Edwards and Roy point out, when universities reward departments for ranking highly, which is something that happens a lot, it's kind of like with No Child Left Behind, you know, with, like, you know, grade school. If the departments rank highly, they get, you know, more money. And this actually incentivizes departments to, as Edwards and Roy say, reverse engineer game and cheat rankings. And they see sort of observable effects of this, and they map this out in their paper. And that, of course, also erodes the integrity of scientific institutions themselves. So this is a long, winding way to say that the trickle-down effect of whatever sort of, like, R&D investment we see is, I think, dwarfed by the incredible crisis in academic science, the crisis of integrity, that is.
Right. So you basically, it's going to be, like, less discovering, you know, the structure of DNA and more Thanos, or whatever the hell that thing was called, essentially.
Yep.
Right.
Theranos. Yeah.
I believe she's actually mounting a comeback, if I understand correctly. But
great,
yeah, no,
bring her back,
yeah, totally. Well, she makes for good grant copy. You have a great you cite and translate research really, really well in this piece, and usually, as always, is typical of your work. But you also have a kind of really great personalized case study of this. And it's a gentleman by the name of Peter Higgs, who won a Nobel Prize in 2013. Now, if you were just looking at this from the outside, you know, one would assume that somebody whose research going back to the 60s, which culminated in a Nobel Prize, would be the toast of his department and, you know, insulated in sort of, you know, acolytes and professional and social recognition. But actually, no.
Right. On the contrary. So Peter Higgs, I should say, he's the British theoretical physicist who, in 1964, he predicted the existence of the Higgs boson particle, sometimes called the God particle, which he doesn't like. But anyway, you might recognize it. He won the Nobel Prize in 2013 for that work that he had done in the 60s. And after winning, he sat down with The Guardian, and on his, you know, sort of inaugural interview, they basically were like, do you have anything to say, Peter Higgs, about academic science? And instead of saying what you might expect him to say, he said, quote, it's difficult to imagine how I would ever have enough peace and quiet in the present sort of climate to do what I did in 1964. Today, I wouldn't get an academic job. It's as simple as that. I don't think I would regard it as productive enough. Right. And he also said that in the latter years of his career at Edinburgh University, he became, quote, an embarrassment to the department when they did research assessment exercises. So they would send around an email saying, please give us a list of your recent publications. And he would send back a statement saying, nothing, none. I don't have any recent publications. And according to him, the university kept him around despite his insufficient productivity, solely in the hopes that he would win the Nobel Prize, which would then be a boon to the brand of the university in this contemporary sink-or-swim environment where there's more austerity and less public funding. So Peter Higgs basically narrowly escaped the fate of being given the axe solely on the basis that he had conducted research in the 1960s under a completely different climate, which had led to major breakthroughs in theoretical physics. I think that that's a really interesting case study, because one of the things also is he basically speaks to that point I mentioned earlier, which is if you're chasing grants and citations, you're losing opportunities for careful contemplation and deep exploration.
That's I think what's amazing and so fast and disturbing but elegant about that is when you bring in essentially like the time politics dimension of it, and the discipline and regimes that basically capitalism instills in people to, you know, hyper efficient, you know, limit them and constrain them as workers, but then also rob them of any time to be fully developed human beings, which of course spills into their work if one is allowed to have it spill into their work, and you do a type of work like theoretical physics where you do actually, you know, literally sort of need that time. But it kind of perfectly bridges the whole chain of how science is being distorted by capitalism, because you could take, you know, examples that we've already known, you know, for quite some time, like why is it that there's so little R&D and research, you know, that's sort of desperately underfunded to deal with things like malaria, as an example. Well, because there isn't a market for that kind of drug research. It primarily, affects poor people in underdeveloped economies. So why would we put our research into that? And if the universities and the commons and the public sector are undermined, and pharma's driving the show, there's not going to be solutions for those sort of problems. And then that actually runs up the chain to, this is somebody who really actually revealed something about like the foundations of our universe and where we came from, you know, these kind of really deep things that are also really important. And he's saying, I wouldn't have been able to give this to you in this environment. And that's kind of a mind-blowing, like, we wouldn't learn something that is foundational to like the whole game of us even being here to begin with because of like some type of new dumb citation metric. I mean, let that sink in.
Right. I mean, it's it's not that we wouldn't learn something.
Yeah, maybe we would.
We aren't learning things right now. There are things right now that we're missing out on because there are brilliant scientists who are spending their time doing things other than finding out the deep, complex truths of our universe, right? So I think that this is a problem that we're actually experiencing the negative effects of quietly right now. We have more brilliant people with more institutional support and more basic fundamental knowledge to work from than ever in human history. And yet we also are not seeing the fruits of that fully come to bear because we are basically distracting these people, selling their own labor on a market instead of, you know, sitting and thinking and working and quietly sort of searching for the more complex truths that govern our universe.
Two quick questions to sum up. Number one, is there within the scientific community, I mean, there's these different inklings across sectors. I mean, we saw it in the teacher strikes as an example, and and obviously people facing much more raw economic pressure. But is there some sense of politicization in these communities as a result of this environment?
I don't think it's, I mean, I think that the answer is yes, but also not enough, right? Yeah. So one of the things about science workers is that, like many academics, notoriously hard to organize. So teachers, funny, people talk about education and logistics and hospitals as basically being contemporary factories. So you have Amazon warehouses that are look actually quite similar to factories, and then you have, but you also have, you have schools and you have hospitals, and these are places where workers sort of all work in really similar conditions. They work in, facilities, unbounded facilities, and they're able to sort of communicate with each other. And that might be why we see the teachers' strikes, and we see, nurses are some of the more militant workers in the labor movement. Yep. And you also see, attempts to organize logistics workers, UPS workers, Amazon workers, and things like that. But academics are funny. They're in a kind of liminal space because they're both workers in these big sort of like nouveau factory-like settings. The university is certainly one of those, but they're also, middle-class professionals who are essentially curators of their own brand, selling their own labor on a market and being their own sort of brand ambassadors, which is quite different from, how a nurse works in a hospital. And to some extent, you lose solidarity among workers when they're sort of looking out for themselves. And so I think that that's been a major complaint about the ability to organize academics against some of these things. And it's also true that it's not obvious who the boss is that you're supposed to put pressure on. I mean, essentially, it comes down to probably the root is like a combination of university administrations, which continue to impose these neoliberal performance metrics, and then the federal government itself, which continually cuts off funding to universities, as well as state governments. But it's when you don't have solidarity and you don't have people thinking of themselves as workers and you don't have them thinking of themselves as, a united class that's facing a collective problem as opposed to individual problems, it's very hard to attack those. It's very hard to stand up to those, root causes and those major agents of the problem, right?
Absolutely. Final question. And this is on my mind. I just recorded earlier today, dissection for Michael Brooks' show of this new Steve Pinker book, and there's a lot of problems in it. And one of the things that struck me is that right now, and this is actually another great example of the real problem in public discourse of not having Marx in the game. And I'm not even saying, whatever, people can be Marxist or not Marxist, whatever, but this positioning that so many of the, because people like Steve Pinker, who evangelize for this thing called science, quote unquote, are positioning themselves against, reactionaries and religious fanatics or whoever else who sort of deny basic scientific realities, and also in a more, serious way can gun for, educational curriculums, attack public health. I mean, those are serious policy issues. And then on the other hand, there's this caricature of a sort of, ridiculous postmodernist position, which might exist in some area. It's a combination of first, in some ways, misrepresenting people's positions, and then in other ways, like, yes, maybe you could find like an assistant anthro professor at some college somewhere who said, who made like some ludicrous blank slate argument or something that denied, certain things that we have discovered about, how brains work, whatever. And it's totally over-exaggerated and also used as a cudgel by people like Pinker to not deal with the politics of science and negate really important conversations about race and gender and class and so on. But at the same time, because there isn't any of this foundational understanding of how literally the scientific enterprise happens from an actual material point of view and what actually drives it, you have a position where the people who are sort of primarily identified with in the public mind with being the brand ambassadors and asserters of science have nothing to say. In fact, to an extent they do have anything to say, they're part of the problem you're identifying because they buy market logic on everything. So as part of parcel of their call for science is also this push towards the neoliberalization, which will, you know, be used on behalf of corporations, not people, and also make us miss out on actual breakthroughs in innovation because of the environment you described. And to me, I think that is because a materialist analysis isn't in play.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that this is a false dichotomy between the sort of like reactionary forces of the contemporary dark age who don't believe in science. And then there's like somehow the real defenders of science who also happen to be pro-capitalist and pro-neoliberal and pro-austerity and pro-market logic. I mean, we have to basically say, no, actually, those two positions can be collapsed into one another to some extent. And then we can stake out a second position, which is that we are so pro-science socialists, right? We actually care about public funding and we care about eliminating the dominance of the profit motive over science because we care about science and because we think it's important and we want to protect it. And then I'll circle back around and explain that a little bit better when I say that those two things can be collapsed together, the sort of like pro-capitalist position and the sort of reactionary anti-science position. The former feeds the latter, and this is something that Edwards and Roy get into in their article. They wrote, I'm just going to read a quote. They're talking about the potentially catastrophic effects of this neoliberal marketization and privatization on science itself. And they write, the combination of perverse incentives and decreased funding increases pressures that can lead to unethical behavior. If a critical mass of scientists become untrustworthy, a tipping point is possible in which the scientific enterprise itself becomes inherently corrupt and the public loses trust, risking a new dark age with devastating consequences to humanity. So you see how
fake news.
The point that I'm trying to make is that the sort of like rosy go along with capitalism, go along with marketization kind of position is actually really playing with fire. In terms of this contemporary dark age anti-science attitude, because it's possibly eroding the integrity of the scientific endeavor. And if we care about the integrity of the scientific endeavor and public trust in science, what we're going to have to do is publicly fund science and protect it for the public well-being as opposed to just simply for private profit.
Megan Day, the piece is Capitalism is Ruining Science. Creeping marketization has created perverse incentive structures for researchers, threatening the wholesale corruption of science itself. It's in Jacobin. It's an incredibly important piece, as really, I mean, I basically think all your pieces are. So Megan Day, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for doing this.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to get to the fun half in a second. I'm going to try to have it be a call and I am heavy fun half because I know that they've been light. What did you say, Matt?
Did we do any calls yesterday?
We didn't do any calls yesterday, so I'm going to try to make up for it. But we do have to end relatively tightly, but we're gonna prioritize the call and IM side.
We do have a good clip of Piers Morgan getting dunked on.
It's a beautiful clip. It will bring a smile to everybody's face. You know how much, like, Piers Morgan is such a waste of space that he needs to be so thoroughly dunked on in order for me to even say his name, let alone play a clip with his big puffiness in it. So this one is definitely worth it. That, I can tell you, it's true. On the Michael Brooks Show on Tuesday, great conversation with Professor Harvey Kay on the American social democratic tradition. We got in some really deep debates about fascism, about whether or not to be Democrats in the post game for patrons. This Sunday, Merrick Sullivan, who is a PhD candidate in Oxford University, and I do a sort of intellectually intellectual history dissection of Steve Pinker's new book, which relates to some of the themes that Megan was covering there. Next week, Matt Taibbi's in studio for TMBS. Yesterday marked the year-long anniversary of the launch of the Patreon campaign for the show, and a lot of you obviously become patrons and support it. I want to thank all of you and really spread the word. It's been a successful year, and we're doing great work. So check it out at patreon.com/TMBS. Next week, our YouTube channel is launching, and also subscribe to it on iTunes, Michael Brooks Show. And thank you, everybody, for spreading the word. We've had a couple, people that surprised me. They're like, oh yeah, I watch TMBS, listen to TMBS. So it's great. And thanks everybody for making that happen. Jamie, what's going on?
Oh man.
What's cooking?
Our current episode, still good. We talk about the New Yorker Union with my friend Aaron, who is part of the organizing drive. They just got recognized, which is very exciting. We talk about labor history. I talk about my unsuccessful attempt to organize my former company, which
was... Oh, word?
Yeah, I learned a lot from it. Very frustrating, disappointing.
Do you dish a lot on
Do you
them?
Dish on
A
the...
bit, a bit, yeah, yeah.
Dish.
And this weekend, we're going to record a new episode that's going to be super great as well. And, just have to wait and see how that turns out.
Literary hangover. Have you recorded hungover yet, Matt?
No, I don't actually do a lot of drinking anymore.
Do you do a water boat where you're high during the show?
No right? comment. Episode 3, Sleepy Indeed. Hollow. This yes. is when you got to edit the gaps a little bit shorter so it makes it sound like you're quicker. Episode 3, Sleepy Hollow, the Ichabod Crane story. You think you've heard it, but maybe you actually have, but check it out on iTunes, Stitcher, all that stuff. Or it's on YouTube too if you want to subscribe to that channel. There it is.
Sweet. Good to get some sort of getting us in a different zone, making us think about literature is like it's like our cultural antenna, and you can anticipate a lot of stuff with literature. Of course, you can join the Majority Report at majority.fm/become a member, justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. We're still doing gangbusters on the YouTube channel, so
YouTube channel is just rocketing up like a NASA spaceship.
Like a NASA spaceship.
Not made by private companies. Just actually made by...
Not Musk. Like a 1960s with those fucking great thin ties and the Coke bottle glasses. And they were just like, JFK said we need to go to space, see? We're going to do it with less computing power than an iPhone. And that was because of the federal government, bitches. See you in the fun half.